This is Rumble's Drip, Good Conversation That Takes Its Time. I'm Erica Heilman. Today, part one of a story that I am running in honor of Veterans Day called An American Life. A number of years ago, my sister told me she had a feeling that I should maybe talk with her hairdresser. Von Hood ran a salon with his wife Bev in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, and my sister said that he had mentioned his time in Vietnam to her while he was cutting her hair. They didn't talk much about it, but she thought maybe somebody should. It turned out that Von hadn't really talked with anyone about his time in Vietnam, or not at great length. So he sat down in the back of his salon one day, in those chairs with the attached dryer helmets, and I turned on my recorder, and we had one of the most extraordinary conversations I've had in my life. Here's An American Life with Von Hood.
I grew up in a small town in southeastern Michigan. It had a population of 150. And most everybody worked in factories. I'm from working people. And I'd overheard my father say that he'd like one of his sons to become a barber. He grew up during the Depression. So he said barbers didn't make very much money, but he said they got a dime a haircut. They did make money, whereas he said nobody else made money. So he thought barbering was Depression-proof. So when I realized I couldn't go to college, I decided, I guess I could be a barber. So I saved my money for about 6 months and had enough money to pay for my tuition to barber school, which was quite an experience for me being a country boy, because it was in Detroit, Michigan. Couldn't believe how tall the buildings were, you know. And there was a guy there that was a porn star, but he was getting too old to be a porn star anymore, so he was going into barbering as sort of a second occupation, you know. My mom would have, you know, never understood that sort of thing, but I thought it was very cool. I excelled at barbering, and I heard about a competition down in Ohio. It was called the United States Barber Spectacular. They had shows all over the country, so I decided to compete in it. And I competed against, I think, about 35 other barbers, and I won, which shocked me. I was 18. I got drafted while I was in school, last 3 months of school. But the owner of the school sent him back a scathing letter and demanded that they let me finish school. So I finished school, and then I went into the military. March of 1968, I was 5'8", and I weighed 118 pounds. Yeah, if I'd have known it, I could probably lost 5 pounds. They probably wouldn't have taken me, but I didn't know that. So here I am, I'm a 118-pound hairdresser. I go in the military, and I knew I was going to Vietnam. So I sold anything that I owned. I wrote my fiance a Dear Mary letter. Broke off with her because I didn't want to have the responsibility of trying to come home to somebody. And then I also sat down with my mom before I left. And we sat down at the kitchen table and I said, Mom, I said, I'm going to Vietnam. I don't know if I'll make it home alive or not. I said, so this is who I want to have speak at my funeral. This is where I want to be buried at. And this is who I want my possessions to go to, my brother and my sister. And she said, yes, she would take care of that. And I said, I've got another favor of you to ask you. I said, when I leave, I said, I would appreciate it very much if you didn't cry. And, you know, looking back on it now, I think that's a hell of a thing to ask your mother, you know. And when I left on the bus, she did not cry. The reason I said that was because I thought the only reason she'd want to cry is if she thought I wasn't coming home. So it was symbolic for me. So I went to Vietnam. I ended up in the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, which is Custer's old battalion. And I like to say it hasn't changed any. The sergeant of the company met me when I got off the helicopter. And he says, welcome to Delta Company, Sergeant Hood. He said, if you survive your first 3 months here, he says, you'll probably survive your tour. He said, but most people don't survive their first 3 months. So he's sort of giving me the straight poop. But anyway, I was taken and introduced to my men. I was put in 2nd Platoon, and I got 2nd Squad. Delta Company had a few nicknames. One was Dying Delta, and the other one was No Deros Delta. Your Deros date is your discharge date. I think the year that I was there, we probably had over 300 casualties. And this is out of a company of 140. I think we had probably close to 35 killed out of the over 300 casualties. So the odds were poor. Hardly anybody survived the first 3 months. Anybody who did survive the first 3 months was considered an old timer. Of course, I survived my whole tour, so I saw a lot. I'm a little embarrassed about saying it, but I do want to say it because I want to put out how I did. You know, I was awarded the Bronze Star. I was awarded the Army Commendation Medal for heroism. I was given the Purple Heart, and I was also got the Air Defense Medal for having over 90 combat flights. So what I'm saying is I served honorably. I don't consider myself a brave person. I don't like conflict. I avoid conflict. I would rather hide than have confrontation. I'm a gentle person. I'm a hairdresser, for Christ's sakes. I'm a small person. I am probably as unlikely a person to have been through what I've been through as you could possibly get. I mean, I was 118 pounds, you know? I was 5'8", and they made me a goddamn sergeant. I mean, is that stupid or what? That is not exactly what you'd call leader material, you know what I'm saying? And I also didn't believe in the war. I didn't know what it was about. I had no idea. What the hell are we doing here? Our job was search and make contact. If the intelligence had a report that there was a certain size unit in a certain area, they would fly us into the area and drop us off and let us walk around until we ran into that unit. And judging by the weapons that they fired at us, they could decide if it was indeed that size unit or not, because certain size units carry certain size weapons. So basically what we were sent in to do was to draw fire. And then we would get ourselves out as best we could and then move on to the next project. The first time that my squad walked into an ambush, my point man was killed right off the bat, which was pretty typical when you walked into an ambush. You usually lost at least one, if not two or three or four or five or whatever. So my point man got killed. At least we were pretty sure he was dead. We weren't positive, but we were pretty sure. And the significance of that is that if he were alive, we would stay there no matter what it took and get him out. He would generally, oftentimes lose people trying to get people out. But because we were pretty sure he was dead, we pulled back and left him. And then we called in air support. So Phantom jets came in, dropping 300-pound bombs and napalm. They just beat the area with bombs and napalm. So when they got done with that, we went back in to, well, one, see if there were any enemy left, but also to pick up our man. And we expected to find a crispy critter in there, if we found anything, you know, because there's no trees left and there's just big holes in the ground and everything's burnt to a crisp, you know, everything's black and ash. But anyway, we walked back in and here he was sitting against a tree. He was dead. He had a bullet hole through the center of his forehead, and his eyes were wide open, and his uniform was not burned. The bark around his body where he was leaning against the tree was not burned, and the grass around his body was not burned. And that was the only thing around there that wasn't burned. So it was spooky. It was like the spirit of the man had stayed and protected him. And we're just all standing there looking at it like, holy mackerel, this is really weird, you know. That was my first time in combat. people don't understand how thick jungle is. Jungle is thick. I mean, you can't see 5 feet through the jungle. I mean, it's thick. So if you walked into an ambush, you still wouldn't see them. You could be in contact 100 times and never see a live NVA. You could lose, you know, dozens of men, still never see one. And I remember, I thought, well, if I just could see one, because, you know, I've been a hunter all my life, you know. Then one day, I actually saw one. He was standing in an open bunker. So I took my M16 and I switched it over to fully automatic, which we called rock and roll. And I took a very careful bead on him, and I squeezed the trigger. My gun misfired. My one chance, my gun misfired. I think my men trusted me, and I asked things of them that seem impossible, that they would do those things for you. Sometimes it's give your life. I didn't really have a problem with, I didn't feel particularly bad when people got killed. I mean, you'll feel bad, but that's what we were there for. You had to be willing to die. Or not willing, it didn't matter. People died. What I felt bad about was people being maimed. When I gave an order and people were maimed, that really bothered me. It still bothers me. They spent the rest of their lives maimed. And they did that for me. And they did that for you, and they did that for everybody. You know, they knew what they were doing. I lost one young man that I was close to. He was supposed to go back to the States to marry his fiance, because she was pregnant. And they were going to give him permission to go back. He only had a few days before he was going to go back. And at that time, I was a platoon sergeant rather than a squad leader. And I took him on as my RTO, my radio telephone operator. So he was with me in the middle of the platoon rather than with a squad where he normally would be. Where my old squad walked into an ambush again. They were under heavy fire. And my RTO... his name was Jerry Clute. He said, "Sarge, I want to go help him." And I said, "Jerry, you're your own man. If you want to go up there, go." So he did. He just put his radio down and he ran up there, you know, to help his squad. Anyway. He was shot by a sniper. He didn't last 5 minutes. The squad called back and said Jerry was hit. So I ran up and carried Jerry back and left him. And then I ran back up and I had to get my men out. So we got them all back. But he died under his own will. He wanted to go up. And I didn't stop him from going up. I could have. I mean, I was his sergeant. I could say, "No, you can't go up there," you know, but I didn't. And he did what he wanted to do, and he died that way. I think it's extremely honorable. It brings tears to my eyes because he was a great man. I wasn't a good soldier. I tried to protect my men. I tried to protect my squad, my platoon. Let's say my squad would be sent out on a 360, a patrol around a NDP, night defensive position. If I had to, I'd do a 360. But if I didn't have to, if nobody was keeping an eye on me, I'd take my men out maybe 100 meters. We'd sit down, write letters, smoke cigarettes. The radio man would call in every now and then on our progress, you know. And then a couple hours, which is normally what it would take to do a 360, we'd just get up and walk straight back in again. I mean, why would we want in a squad, be by ourselves out in a jungle in contact with an enemy with no help? I mean, you're just going to lose men, right? So I'd rather than do that. If I could not follow orders, I did not follow orders. And I think that's, well, I know that's part of why so many of my men survived. There was another sergeant in the company. I had one of the other platoons. We called him Sergeant Rock. I don't even know his name. But the Rock had been there. This was his third tour in the jungle. Anybody that survived one was doing well, let alone three. So he had everybody's respect. I modeled myself after the Rock. And I was in the rear at one point. And when I say the rear, I mean a LZ, which is not exactly the rear. It's a fortified area out in the middle of the jungle. Maybe I was wounded or something. I don't know why I was there. But the Rock happened to be there at the same time. And the men had asked him to check me out and see if I was cool. And so Rock takes me off to the side, tries to get me stoned. And that's what it would mean to be cool, whether they could be stoned with me or not, you know. Anyway, he takes me to get me stoned. It took a while, but he got me stoned. And there was a cafeteria there. And so we raided the cafeteria. We found white bread and mayonnaise and pepper. So we had mayonnaise and pepper sandwiches. They were delicious. We went back to the field. He told them that I was cool. So all of a sudden, I was accepted. When you're out in the field, fear hits you eventually. You can be there for a little while without being afraid. But eventually, fear is going to hit. It doesn't change anything. It just means you still got to be there, only in fear. The fear finally hit the Rock. And he wanted a rear job. So they made a job for him because they didn't really have a job for him. It was nice of them to do that. His job was killing rats. Rats come in from the jungle all over the place. So he would kill rats, and he started drinking a lot of beer, at least a case a day, and he would smoke pot all day long. And he came up to me one day. He says, Vaughn, he says, I want to find myself. He said, like you. So anyway, he continued with his drinking and his smoking, and he started taking crystal meth. He'd take it by the spoonful. And one day he comes up to me and he says, Vaughn, he says, I think I found myself. And there was just nobody home. He was gone. He wasn't there anymore. He was checked out. The man I patterned myself after. We called ourselves grunts, you know. When a grunt would run into a grunt, you'd say, hey man, what's happening? And the response to that is, hey man, it don't mean nothing. It don't mean nothing, man. That was our, hello, how are you? Hey, what's happening, man? It don't mean nothing, man. It don't mean nothing. I have PTSD. It visits me every day. I live with it every day. You learn to cope. You learn to cope. I'm sorry about being emotional. People have no idea. They have no idea. They turn me into a killer. Okay? I am not a killer. They're very good at it. They're very good at it. And of course, that was my job. People really don't understand that. A lot of people, most people probably say, oh, I could never kill somebody. Well, they could. Given the right circumstances and the right place at the right time, they could. And they could do a whole lot worse. They're kidding themselves. Now I know what I'm capable of, and I know what other people are capable of. By the time I got home, I couldn't feel anything. I was emotionally cold. There were times when I wanted to feel something for somebody I cared about, I couldn't feel anything. It just wasn't there. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was suffering from survivor's guilt. I wanted to prove that I had a right to be alive. I wanted to prove that those men who died around me didn't die for nothing. And the only way I could do that was to be the very best that I could be, to live on for them, which is way too much responsibility for a 20-year-old man. But that's the way it was. The only way I could be as good as I could be was to do it through my work. So I was this long-haired barber standing in the window of a barber shop a half a block from the University of Michigan. Who's a long-haired person going to go to? I started getting busier and busier. Before long, I was booked like 2 weeks ahead. And I was working 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. I decided every time I booked 2 weeks ahead, I'd raise my prices $2. By the end of a year and a half, we were $16 for a haircut, which was unheard of at the time. And I thought, when I opened the place, I thought, where in the hell am I going to find anybody stupid enough to cut hair like I do? But what would happen was that young barbers would come in and say, can I watch you? And I'd say, sure. So they'd watch me. They'd go back to their barbershop and try to do what I was doing. And they'd get fired from their job. And they'd come back to my shop and ask me if they could work for me. And I'd say yes. I was using my work to get back in touch with me. I would work myself to a point of exhaustion. Then I would focus on something that would have some kind of an emotion involved with it. And I would use the energy from that to keep working. But using ideas that were connected to emotion that I was out of touch with. I don't even know what I was focusing on when I was trying to evoke an emotion. I just knew that I was working past my limits. I wanted to feel things again. I was fighting a battle in myself using haircutting to get there. I was doing it for those people who died. Shortly after I got back, I took a course in transcendental meditation, and I started practicing that. And probably about a year and a half or so, or two after I got back, I was driving a car, and I started going through a conflict that I had with another person in my mind. And I got angry. And I was so involved with the thought process that I drove someplace where I didn't intend to drive, and I didn't even remember driving there. And it scared me. And all of a sudden I started crying. And I couldn't stop. And that scared me. So I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm losing it. I need help. So I headed for a hospital. And as I got closer and closer to the hospital, I kept driving faster and faster, and I was like going through stop signs and running red lights, and you know, it was dangerous, you know. And I saw this guy walking down the sidewalk, and I pulled over my car and I said, I'm having a nervous breakdown, will you drive me to the hospital? So he jumped in my car and drove me to the hospital, and I walked into the emergency room and I said, I think I'm having a nervous breakdown, I need some help. They got me in with a psych person, and he just recommended that I just go home and sleep on it, and you know. So I went home, at least I wasn't crying anymore, and I felt like I was losing it, you know. And it scared me, because if I was losing it, I thought I was dangerous, because I had lost myself a few times in combat, too, and I was dangerous. And I didn't want to hurt anybody. So rather than hurt somebody, I thought maybe I should just kill myself. But anyway, I sat down on the couch with my legs stretched out on the couch, and I started practicing TM, meditating. Well, almost immediately, I felt my head being forced down to my chest, and I felt this, what in my mind's eye appeared to be like this golden light that was coming out from behind my head, out over my head, just flowing out. It felt solid, you know, And it just flowed, and it flowed, and it flowed, and it flowed. I just fell asleep right there where I was at. I woke up in the morning, and I felt powerful. Powerful. I don't know what it was. I don't know what happened. I don't know. I have no idea. But whatever it was a good thing. When I was a little kid, 10 years old maybe, I don't know, riding my bike in my hometown, which I did a lot. I was riding my bike and I looked up at the sky and I thought, how far does the sky go? I tried to imagine how far the sky went, and I just couldn't imagine it. And I thought, well, that must be eternity, you know? And then I thought, well, I'm gonna do whatever I have to do in my life to make sure I don't have to come back again. I don't know why. I mean, I had that thought. I remember it. So I've tried to live my life that way. And I think I have achieved that. I have lived my life so that I do believe I have a choice of whether I come back or not. But now that I feel that way, now I want to come back. I got to a point where I had a choice, whereas before I didn't have a choice. Now I do want to come back. I'm a good person. I'm as good a man as there is. I do the very best I can every day with every bit of work that I do. I don't hold back. And I feel that everybody else should do the same. Because I have lots of reasons not to. I could say, screw you all. Fuck you guys. I mean, this society has brutalized me. They have hurt me. And I carry the wounds. But yet I give to them every day. I give them all I've got. Yeah, it's the way it is.
That was Vaughn Hood. He and Bev live in California now. Vaughn is currently writing a book about his time in Vietnam. This show was produced by me and by the late, great Larry Massett. Music for this show is by callous Vermont musician Brian Clark. If you want to get in touch with me or write a note to Vaughn, you can email me at rumblestripvermont@gmail.com and I will make sure he gets it. Rumblestrip is distributed on the radio by Vermont Public. This is Rumblestrip. I'm Erica Heilman.